Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and today it's how politics and one man took down a nation's foods. It's hard to imagine Spanish food being awful, but it was pretty close, and that wasn't very long ago. I mean, today we've got those glorious tapas and the paellas and the hams. I mean, Spain has even birthed a brand new way of cooking. But roll back just four decades, and you had a ruler named Franco who squashed Spain's traditions with his political agenda. Well, we're going to learn how Spain's food regained its soul with food expert Claudia Roden. Stay with us for this and a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is brought to you by Bing. Only Bing now integrates information from your friends on Facebook and experts on Twitter so you can tap into their knowledge and opinions. Now, search goes social with Bing.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. For all the supposed laziness of summer, I think it's when we get restless, when we want to strike out for places we've never been and taste new tastes. Well, we've got those yearnings covered this hour, at least the eating portion of them. Peter John Lindbergh leaves town for a living. He's a travel writer, and among his gigs is that of editor-at-large for Travel and Leisure magazine. Hey, Peter, good to have you back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
So you're traveling all over the world, but when you land in a country, especially one you don't know very well, is there a way that you sort of begin to understand what the food's about?
You know, one of the first stops that I make in any foreign place, the minute that I get to town, I try and hit the local supermarket. I think that just gives a great sort of introduction, primer, kind of a roadmap almost, if you will, to the local cuisine and to the culture as a whole.
So you're not going to that open-air market that everybody hears about?
I love an open-air market. I love those quaint sort of traditional, you know, farmer's stands and whatnot. I think that's great. I think a supermarket is almost a more accurate and kind of genuine introduction to the culture because, you know, no one postures in a supermarket. You know, you're not really going to – it's kind of an unfiltered view, you know, under these bright lights. You know, you're going to see the real culture and the real secret appetites and cravings of the people.
So, I mean, do you hang out and just study what people are putting in their baskets or
– I'm not that creepy guy. I follow them around and – I actually go in there just to shop for my own food. I mean, occasionally I'll sort of, you know, sneak a peek at what other people are buying, especially if it looks delicious. But I'll go in and I'll usually just fill a whole cart myself. And, you know, by the time that I come home from a trip, I mean, half my suitcase will be filled with groceries.
So what kinds of things do you go for?
I go in for sort of two things. I mean, for one thing, I'm looking for great packaging because I think that the food packaging in foreign countries is always either, you know, unintentionally funny or it's really kind of beautiful. I mean, you know, there's tins of tuna in Spain that, you know, are just sort of gorgeous that you want to put on your mantle. But also for the, you know, the sort of novelty item foods that you can take home as souvenirs are always fun. I mean, everybody likes, you know, hamburger-flavored chewing gum and cucumber-flavored Pepsi and all that kind of thing that you find overseas.
Yeah, yeah. But
I also go in just for snacks. I mean, you know, there's these squid potato chips that you can get in Japan and Korea that are just, you know, breathtakingly good. And then durian candy in Thailand, I'll go for that. I'm crazy obsessed with, call me crazy, but I'm obsessed with Bachelor mushy peas from the UK.
Bachelor mushy peas?
Bachelor brand mushy peas. Yeah, they just come in a can, and I actually have been known to eat them straight out of the can. I crave them when I'm not in England.
Are these crushed peas?
Yeah, they're kind of it's almost like a split pea soup in a can, but really delicious. I don't know why I like it so much. I think I had them when I was a child, and I really became obsessed with them. So those are some of the things that I get. I also go. Honestly, I go straight for the yogurt section in whatever country I'm in because, you know, I found over the course of my travels, yogurt is like the soccer of food. It's like the entire world appreciates it better than we do, you know, and makes it better than we do. You know, we're stuck with like, you know, 1% Activia and whatnot. And they're over there with these, you know, these dainty little glass jars and these ceramic little pots that you can buy things in and you get to keep them, you know, at the end, you can bring them home. But the yogurt is invariably just way, way better than anything you've ever had. And the yogurt section is always huge. You know, it's like the size of our soda section. But in any country you go to, you know, from Argentina to obviously France and Japan and beyond, it's pretty mind-blowing.
What country you think has the best supermarkets?
Well, you know, it has to be Japan because, first of all, they have just great supermarkets to begin with, these big, giant, sort of gleaming, you know, Shangri-Las of commerce. And, of course, the packaging is always really, really something to see. You kind of feel like everyone there is marketing to children because it's like everything's sort of packaged like sugar-charged breakfast cereal.
Yeah.
One of the best things that you can get in Japan is every season they'll come out with a whole new line of Kit Kat flavors. It's not just a typical Kit Kat bar that you find in the States. They'll have, you know, anything from cherry blossom flavored Kit Kat in the spring to, candied potato in the wintertime or chestnut flavored in the fall. I think they have something like 200 different flavors that they release throughout the year. So you can find those at little convenience stores or in the supermarket, and people will literally line up when they come out on the day of the release.
What a great idea for gifts.
Yeah, it's terrific for souvenirs. And, you know, I think U.S. Customs is not really a fan of me when I come back with two entire bags filled with stuff from the supermarket.
I picture your mantle with all of these things displayed on it.
I have this can of borscht that I got in Moscow that's like this beautiful kind of constructivist logo. I mean, it looks like something from the 40s, but I bought it, you know, like 4 years ago. I don't think I'll ever crack it open.
I never thought about it, but labels is art. Hey, Peter, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
Peter John Lindbergh's piece, The World's Strangest Supermarket Items, appeared in the July 2011 issue of Travel and Leisure magazine. You know, thinking of Peter's finds, I looked at my own condiment collection. It's embarrassing in size. But I realize that there's a lot you can pick up here and there, right here in the States. And these condiments are shortcuts to great flavors. For instance, for starters, maybe you have balsamic vinegar, chipotle chilies and adobo, hoisin sauce, tamarind, barbecue sauces, coconut milk, fish sauce, hot sauces from just about everywhere. And then you could have French tapenade, Italian dried tomatoes, Thai curry paste, and even Mexican quince paste. So you look at these and you let the imagination rip. For instance, for a spice summer chicken pot, mix up the coconut milk with tamarind and hot sauce and quince paste to taste. That's tart, hot, and sweet. The combination never fails. Cook in this some chicken, tomatoes, and peppers, and top everything off with handfuls of fresh mint and chopped onion. So, take some time to look at that refrigerator door with maybe new eyes. If you want to know where to eat in L.A., the food trucks, the neighborhoods, the markets, Check out Angela Kim's blog. Angela is here. Hey, Angela, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Well, yeah, from reading your blog, I know that you're really knee-deep in the ethnic food scene. So where do you go for cool-down foods in the heat of the summer?
A lot of people will be surprised, but I go to Koreatown. And I know a lot of people go there for Korean barbecue. But when you go to these little shops, there are these noodle places that have this North Korean dish called mulnaengmyeon. It's a buckwheat noodle served in a chilled, almost icy beef broth vinegar with a slight tinge of sugar flavor.
Ooh.
Soup. It's so great. And it's served with typically like julienned cucumbers, slices of Asian pear, a thin slice of beef, and topped with a boiled egg. And I know a lot of my friends, when I take them there, they kind of look at me like, really?
Yeah, I can understand. But boy, does that sound good.
I mean, it's summer to me, but my father, he eats this year-round. He loves this dish. And I asked my father, I'm like, if you can only have one Korean dish your whole life, what would it be? I thought he was going to say, you know, Korean ribs or some sort of barbecue dish.
Right.
He's like, no, mulnaengmyeon, this noodle. To him, this encompasses a lot of Korean flavors. I think playing with the sweet vinegar, tangy flavor, and eating it with a side of kimchi is just perfection to him. And I don't blame him.
Say the word again, the name of it.
It's mulnaengmyeon.
Okay. So what else?
It's actually a drink, but I kind of think of it as a dish. But there's a great El Salvadorian restaurant just a few blocks from where I live. I just recently discovered it. It's called Yaragua. And they have this drink called ensalada. And when I saw it, I was like, oh, salad, right? It's a salad. And they're like, no, it's a beverage. And they brought it out. And basically, in the tall glass, I would say half the glass was fruit that was just chopped up in tiny, 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 tiny little bits and pieces. And I felt like I should eat it with a spoon. But they recommended I just basically slurp up the fruity juices and then use a spoon to eat the fruit. But they basically chop up apples, pineapples, mangoes, a little bit of cilantro. And I asked them how much sugar they put in it. They don't put any sugar in there at all. It's all natural.
It's the natural juice that comes out of those fruits that actually supplies the liquid.
Oh, yeah. And if you drink this with a nice kind of savory dish, it is so great. Because I usually get a couple of pupusas, which are nice and salty because of all the cheese and grease.
Mm-hmm,
and I have this sweet ensalada beverage that's very, you know, it's very cool and refreshing and icy. It is the best compliment.
Dessert? I'm thinking here now. Come on, you're going to have something icy and cold, right? That's going to be easy.
Well, dessert's my favorite meal. So I actually turned to Hawaii for this one. I love Hawaiian shave ice. And I know my friends from the South say, no, you mean a snowball. Or other people have told me, you mean a snow cone. I'm like, no, Hawaiian shave ice is a category of its own. And I know what you know what I mean because you've been to Hawaii.
Yeah.
It's that like flaky, soft, icy kind of texture. And they have these amazing toppings and flavors that we don't get here. Like you have the lihing mui, which is a salted plum powders, condensed milk. You have red beans. And the amazing thing is like we have a place here in Los Angeles called Get Shaved. And it started out as a food truck. But they now have a storefront. And I love hearing that they have a storefront because I know exactly where they are any time of the day.
You don't have to track them down.
I don't have to track them down. They actually have two places here in Los Angeles. And anytime you go there in the summer, there's this long, long line. But it goes so fast because they just churn out these amazing, fluffy balls of snow for us. And basically, I put like 3-4 different flavors on, going from melon, strawberry, pineapple, and also a little bit of lihing mui, too.
Oh, this sounds fabulous. The thing about that shave ice is the ice is actually shaved. It's not crushed. And that's where that lightness comes from.
Yes. And if you watch, I love watching them make this because they usually have this really clear piece of ice that is, they put it on this machine. It spins around and around and around. It just shaves it so thinly. It's beautiful to watch and even better to eat.
I'm cooling down already. Angela, thanks.
Anytime.
Take a look at Angela Kim's blog. It's called Angela Is Here. Now, you're going to find her eating pics on the website, splendidtable.org, where you can also register for our newsletters, including a brand new one. It's called Sunday Supper. Get information on our latest project, a summertime grilling guide, listen to podcasts, and dig around in our recipe box. There's a ton of stuff there for you. Just go to splendidtable.org. Well, coming up, how Spanish food lost its soul. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is supported by Bing. Only Bing now integrates opinions from your Facebook friends and experts on Twitter to help you make better decisions. For instance, say you're checking out movie options this week. Go to Bing and enter movies. In addition to trailers, reviews, and showtimes, you'll also see movies liked by your Facebook friends and opinions from movie experts on Twitter. And easily post questions and comments to your Facebook friends. All so you spend less time searching and more time doing. Now, search goes social with Bing. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. So sexy today. The tapas, the wines, the smoky paprikas, the return of the brilliant paellas, and Spain is the cradle of the modernist food movement. It's kind of hard to believe that not terribly long ago, people would come back from vacations in Spain talking about how bad the food was. And it was. In fact, going back to 1936, culinary scholar and author Claudia Roden has written The Food of Spain. Well, she joins us today to talk about how Spanish food took back its proverbial place in the sun. Claudia, welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me to the show. I'm so glad to be here.
Claudia, I think about the Franco regime, and when you talk about 39 years, you're talking about bordering on two generations. And what did Franco do to the food?
Well, he suppressed regional cultures, and that included food. And he also suppressed artisan products. They were discouraged in favor of industrial ones that could feed the population cheaply. But I think there was another thing that one can't blame him too much, but it did happen in his regime that they did encourage tourism, and it was cheap, cheap tourism in the costas. And that was one way that they thought they would help their economy. Mm-hmm. And then a kind of cheap food that appears in tourist resorts appeared. And in a way, that's what people got to know.
So during this time, he discouraged the regionalism and the artisanship because he wanted to be able to feed the entire population. Was that his goal?
Yes, yes. He encouraged, for instance, the cheese industry. He made a decree that you had to produce 10,000 liters of milk a day if you were allowed to make cheese. And artisan cheesemakers became illegal. And it's only after 1984, when the decree was repealed, that cheesemakers started making their old crafts again.
The thing I keep thinking, though, in 39 years, people lose the taste for something. They don't remember products all that well. How did it come back?
Yes, after 1978, historic regions, as we know them, became autonomous communities, which had the right to govern themselves. And all of a sudden, people felt free to celebrate their regional heritage. And there was this great feeling of nostalgia throughout the whole country about the old rural life that the booming tourist economy had swept away.
Uh-huh.
And that translated into a newfound passion for regional cooking and for regional products.
I see. So all of this happened after Franco died.
Yes, that's right.
So it really made, I mean, there was a great comeback, very quick comeback, it sounds like.
Yes, there was a quick, I mean, a huge vitality, a huge energy. And for instance, there were organizations formed to preserve their culinary heritage by recording recipes. But also what started was they gave denomination of origin, it DOs, which means that these designations would specify which geographical part this product came from, and also what were the time-honored traditional methods of producing them, and it was also a guarantee of quality. But what also happened at the same time is that the European Union helped them with subsidies so that they really improved their methods of production in every possible way.
What about the modernist movement in food in Spain? Spain's the leader in all of this new food science. And that came out of this whole rebirth?
Well, it was triggered really by France, by the French Nouvelle Cuisine. Because when the French chefs rejected their haute cuisine in favor of Nouvelle Cuisine.
That would be in the 1970s or so, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And at that time, Paul Bocuse came to Spain and he demonstrated their new ways of doing haute cuisine. And all the grand restaurants in Spain only served French food. There was no Spanish haute cuisine. And so young chefs were absolutely enthralled. But very soon after, they thought, why shouldn't we do our Nouvelle Cuisine? And after that, it developed very much. We all know about Ferran Adrià.
Yes.
And what he is doing was to absolutely, completely revolutionize what we think of food and eating. And he was doing things with chemistry and with technology, with machines. He was cooking sous vide and freeze drying and cooking with syringes and making hot jellies and vapors and foams and explosions. And it was a performance, a fine art, really to surprise you, to excite you, to amaze you. And the Spaniards, I think, had been repressed for so long that all this explosion of energy and vitality came into food as well as into other fields.
Claudia, what an exciting place to be right now. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
Claudia Roden's latest book is The Food of Spain. Now, she has a recipe for fish and tomato stew that's finished with almonds and garlic. You can find Peppa's Fish Soup on the website. And by the way, while you're there, listen to the full version of Claudia's interview. You know where to go. SplendidTable.org. Now, if Jane and Michael Stern didn't exist, we would have to invent them. They're the road food warriors, and they've been eating local, well, long before the term ever became fashionable. Jane, Michael, what have you stumbled on this week?
Lynn, you'd never believe this, but the tiny town of San Antonio, New Mexico, used to be known as the home of Conrad Hilton. It is now known as the home of the Green Chili Cheeseburger for the simple reason that this crossroads town with literally no more than three going businesses in it has two restaurants famous for serving fantastically good green chili cheeseburgers, which, as you may know, is virtually the state dish of New Mexico.
Now, is it? It's pretty obvious, but is there a particular formula to the green chili cheeseburger? I mean, that I'll know I'm getting the real thing.
Well, there are a few. I mean, there are all kinds of green chili cheeseburgers. In fact, every year at the state fair, there is a contest for the best green chili cheeseburger in the state, and people go hog wild doing all kinds of things with it. The basic formula is a hamburger with melted cheese and usually chopped chilies. And the interesting thing that many of the restaurants do is to put the chopped chilies on the burger and then melt the cheese on top of the chilies.
Ah.
So they're kind of held in that web of cheese. And, of course, all the difference in the world, aside from quality meat, is made by the quality of the pepper. And, you know, in New Mexico, they do not open a can and dump out some peppers. I mean, these are roasted peppers, and some of them are really, really spicy hot.
Okay, so I'm in this town with three buildings, and two
right.
of them are places to get green chili cheeseburgers. Which one do I go to?
Oh, it's a tough call. They're both really good, and both have their good points. The Owl Bar is one really good one. One of the nice things about that is that it opens at 8 a.m., and you can go in at 8 a.m. and have a green chili cheeseburger for breakfast. We were a little bit shy about doing this when we went to the Owl, but when we sat down, we noticed that other customers sitting at the bar were not only having green chili cheeseburgers, they were also having shots and beers at 8 a.m., so we felt right at home. But actually, for the more deluxe green chili cheeseburger, the bigger, juicier, crustier hamburger, the spicier chili, and maybe better cheese, I'm not sure about that, but certainly bigger. This has got to be an 8 or 10-ounce burger. I would definitely go to the Buckhorn Tavern, which is literally across the street from the Owl. And the Buckhorn serves a stupendously good green chili cheeseburger, the one problem being that it's been discovered. And, you know, this is sort of the bane of our existence. I mean, when we write about a place, maybe some customers will come to it, and that's great. When one of these places gets on TV, suddenly it gets flooded. And the fact is, if you don't get to the Buckhorn Tavern at opening time, 11 a.m., you're going to wait in line for one of these cheeseburgers.
In this little tiny town?
In this no-account town. It's very near Interstate 25, so it's not that hard to get to. But there is nothing else to do in this town except during chili roasting season, there is a chili roaster right in town there, and you can buy bags of freshly roasted chili.
But that aroma is the most incredibly
the
intoxicating. Or is this near Albuquerque?
It's south of Albuquerque.
It's
maybe an hour south of Albuquerque. We went to it. We were driving between.
I was thinking 2 hours, but
I don't know. We were driving between Albuquerque and Las Cruces, and there's not a whole lot between those two cities, but if you're going between them, San Antonio is definitely worth a stop.
I love the Buckhorn because they've kept their modesty. I mean, it's still a very kind of funky, wonderful place, but they have a sign up, which is their bragging sign, saying, "We have been voted the 7th best hamburger in the United States."
Nothing wrong with that.
I guess not, but, you know, really.
I love it. Hey, guys, thanks for the rest stop between Las Cruces and Albuquerque.
You are welcome.
You're welcome,
Lynn. You take care.
The Stearns have written yet more deathless prose in their book, The Lexicon of Real American Food. Now, for their finds, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Andy Ricker is a guy who backpacked his way into Thailand. He went crazy for the street food, came home, and opened a Thai street food stand in Portland, Oregon. He called it Pak Pak. Well, in 2007, Pak Pak made Portland's Restaurant of the Year. Yeah, we're talking a street stand here. Well, I've got Andy with us. Andy, it's good to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me.
I've been hearing from people that you're into a new drink.
That's right.
And it's a very strange kind of new drink.
Some people might think it's strange, but it's actually something that people have been drinking for centuries, mostly for health benefits. But it's also been a very nice sort of different way of getting a refreshing, sweet and bubbly non-alcoholic beverage.
So what is it?
It's drinking vinegar. Basically, it's usually fruit macerated in vinegar and mixed with sugar and water and maybe a little salt to make a concentrate. And from that, you can make a non-alcoholic beverage or mix it with alcohol, as in a shrub, the sort of revolutionary war period drink from the Americas. And also, it's very, very popular in Asia right now.
Now, is this something that's been happening in Asia for a long time, though?
Well, people have been drinking vinegar in Asia for quite a long time. I think the current popularity started probably about 10 years ago, from what I can glean. In Japan, when people started thinking of it as a diet tool.
Yeah.
That's the folk medicine idea. I have no idea whether that's true or not. I can't find any kind of clinical data to back that up.
Well, tell me, how do you do your vinegar drinks?
Well, we, as I said before, we macerate fruit in vinegar for a few days, whatever is seasonal. And then we cook it with sugar and water to dilute to get the acidity sort of in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And then strain it to make a concentrate. Now, that's the simple version. We go about it a little bit more scientifically than that and make sure we get the pH balance right and the sugars correct and everything to make a consistent product.
What does it actually taste like?
Well, the fruit comes through very nicely, and it's slightly tart from the vinegar, but you don't get that really harsh back-of-the-throat flavor you would get if you just drank vinegar straight. So it's quite pleasant.
Where did you first taste these vinegars?
The first time I tasted this vinegar was quite by chance. I was in an Asian market shopping, which I had to do a lot of when we first opened the restaurant because I didn't have the purveyors together to find the product I needed to make what I wanted to make. So I spent a lot of time walking down aisles in Asian markets looking for the stuff that I needed, and I stumbled across, I believe it was a Taiwanese brand of drinking vinegar, and there was a few flavors, I think maybe Taiwan lemon and plum and one other. So I bought one of each, brought them home, tasted them, and went, wow, that's great. So we started selling the store-bought stuff in the restaurant almost immediately. And about a year later, we started experimenting with making our own. And it's grown from there.
Andy, this sounds like something that's really worth a shot. Thanks for telling us about it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Chef Andy Ricker is the creator of Pock Pock, now with locations in both Portland, Oregon, and New York City. Now, you can track down those vinegars in many Asian grocery stores, but don't hesitate to try to make a vinegar sparkler at home with what you've got on hand. Take a small shot of any good-tasting vinegar, apple cider, for example, add some sparkling water, ice, and sweeten to taste. That sour sweet cools you right down on a steamy day. Well, for more summer drink ideas, head to the website, splendidtable.org, and get registered for our monthly book giveaway. This month, it's our new summertime grilling guide. So take a look. Splendidtable.org. This week's trivia challenge is poised for its entrance. Now, the question is, what food did the Rolling Stones write a song about in 1964? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I are going to talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch, connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, email, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what food did the Rolling Stones write a song about in 1964? Well, believe it or not, it was Rice Krispies, and it was just 7 months after their first recording session. They wrote jingles back then, and they took on Rice Krispies with something called Wake Up in the Morning, Snap, Crackle, and Pop. Have a listen.
Wake up in the morning, there's a snap around the place. Wake up in the morning, there's a crackle in your face. Wake up in the morning, there's a pop that really says Rice Krispies to you and you and you. For on the milk.
You gotta wonder if Gaga and Bieber and Katy Perry are going to be able to top that and be around 40 years from now.
hear them talking Rice Krispies.
It's time to get in touch. The lines are open. We're going to be talking with you. Anything goes. Call us at 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Mimi's on the line from Boston. Mimi, hi. What's up?
Hi, Lynn. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question. So I was recently at a company catered party, and they had all of these pans out with all the different, it was a Middle Eastern themed party. So they had all of these just kind of buffet style pans out on the table. And so I noticed the first pan was a big, just kind of like a big lasagna, big pan full right. of white creamy stuff. And so the tag right next to it just said garlic. And so I figured, well, they must have left off the mashed potatoes part of that tag. So, you know, I scoop a whole bunch onto my plate, and, you know, thinking it's probably some sort of garlic mashed potatoes concoction. But so I tried it. It was delicious, so creamy, just unlike anything I had ever tried before. Garlicky, but not pungent. And so I asked one of the hostesses, you know, is this garlic mashed potatoes? And she said, no, it's just mashed garlic with some olive oil and little spices. And so, you know, I was floored. I had never had anything like that. And since then, I've been scouring the internet for any kind of recipe for mashed garlic. I cannot find anything.
I think I know what they did.
Please tell me. Tell me their secret.
Well, there's two ways you can go on this, okay?
Okay.
The trick here is that you slowly cook the garlic.
Okay.
Now, if you take garlic cloves, all right, as many garlic cloves as you can get your hands on.
I've been hoarding about 6 heads in my kitchen.
You are right. You're on your way. You are on your way. Okay. Now, there's the hard way to do this and the easy way to do this.
Okay.
The easy way to do this is that you can wrap those heads, get rid of the just cut off the root end, get rid of most of the skin, but don't do anything more. Wrap those heads in foil, and you can just put them on your grill when you're grilling. And you let them bake. Now, they're going to need about an hour, and you want to bake them covered, you know, so that they stay hot. You could do it in the oven, but if it's too hot to turn on the oven, just do it on the grill, okay?
Okay.
So the idea is you're going to bake these.
Okay.
And you are going to bake them, and then you're going to cool them down, and then what you're going to have is a garlic cream in those cloves, right? So you just pop them out, you mash that, you add olive oil and salt and pepper. A little lemon juice is really good with that.
Okay.
And then you've got this roasted, toasty garlic. The other thing you can do is that you can just peel a whole bunch of cloves, and you can just crush them with a knife and pull off the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And you line the bottom of a really big skillet with good olive oil, throw in salt and pepper, throw in the garlic, and add some water. So if you've got 3 cups of, I'm making, all right, 2 cups of garlic cloves, all right, that you've cut up kind of or crushed, mm-hmm. you want maybe a half a cup of water, and you want to put that over low heat covered, and you just let that cook and cook and cook, and you check it every so often because you don't want to brown the garlic. You want to poach the garlic with that flavor of the oil very gently, and when it's really soft, uncover it, cook off any water that might be left, and then you can just mash that or puree it.
Okay.
Here's the good thing. Now, if you're going to do this, you don't want to store it for a long time. You want to use it fairly soon. Or you can spread out that paste. You can put it in a plastic freezer bag and mm-hmm. mush it so it's like, so you've got it maybe 1/4 inch thick. So it's like a sheet inside the bag, and put it in the freezer. And then you can break off what you want.
Ooh, that sounds good. Is it supposed to be served as an entree or something?
No, this is more of a sauce, but the other thing is, I mean, can you imagine what it's going to be like to dip things in that?
I know.
Or just to spread that on anything? And as you did, you could just eat it as it is. And you know what else is great about it? You can add anything you want to it. I mean, you could add herbs to it. You could even throw some chilies in that pan, or just puree some chilies into the garlic cloves when you mash them. So you see what I'm saying? You can play with this a lot. You can have a lot of fun with it.
Thanks, Lynn. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Have a great summer.
Thanks. I will. You too.
Okay. Bye, Mimi.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. I should have told her this one other thing. You take that poached garlic. You don't need a huge amount of olive oil, but you want to get it really soft. And then you cook up some spaghetti and you toss it with that pasta. Add a little pasta water just to, make a sauce. And the last thing that you do is those first great cherry tomatoes that show up in the farmer's market, just smash them with your hands into that pasta and serve that. You can reach us, send us an email, splendidtable.org. Leave us a message, 800-537-5252, or connect with us on Facebook. Liz in Maryland, who describes herself as a non-cook, she wants to know what she can bring to potluck cookouts, like an appetizer, but that a non-cook is going to use to wow everybody. Okay, a non-cook going to cookout, so we're talking summer. Okay, and you're in Maryland, where there's lots of great produce. I think summer's really on your side here, because there are things you can do that are so dead simple. It's, really, you're going to love this. Number one, you can take tomatoes. This is really easy. You can take small tomatoes, all right? Ones that are maybe, an inch, 2 inches in diameter. Cut them in half. Hollow them out a little bit, drop in a little bit of fresh cheese. It could be a goat cheese, okay? Top them with whatever herbs you like. Torn basil is really a killer. And if you want to get fancy, you can stick a few shelled pistachio nuts into the cheese. Just put those on a tray. That's it. You're done. And you can do them a bit ahead, so it's not a big deal. The other thing you can do is you can take lettuce, okay? You can take out chicken, lettuce leaves, like bib lettuce, because it sits, it makes little cups. Take out chicken, toss that with a little bit of mayonnaise, some really spicy salsa, put that into the lettuce cups, and you serve it. That's it. Everybody reaches for a cup. They kind of fiddle with it with their fingers, and they pop it in their mouths. You just want to use the small inner parts of the lettuce. They will think you are so fancy, I cannot tell you, and you haven't cooked a thing. And you haven't really done much, but you've made great food. So give it a shot. And thanks for writing. Call us, 800-537-5252. Jeff is on the line from Minneapolis. So, Jeff, what is happening?
Hi, Lynn. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's good to talk
Very
to you,
excited.
Too.
Well, my question is, I have hops growing in my yard, like you would use for brewing beer.
Yeah.
And there is tons and tons of them when you get the harvest. And wondering if you had any suggestions with something that flavorful and aromatic. I figured there had to be something you could do besides brewing beer in the kitchen that would be fun and something delicious.
How did you come to hops in your backyard?
We were at a barbecue last summer, and there was hops growing in their yard, and I thought, that's really awesome. So I did some research, and you're actually able to get the rhizomes from a local homebrew store here in town.
So you just decided to grow the hops?
Yeah. We wanted some vines on the back of the garage, and I figured, why not hops?
And they smell really wonderful, don't they?
They really do, yes.
Well, now, the one thing I know about what you do with hops is I know in Belgium, where they do a little bit with beer, to the tune of, 300 some odd different beers or something like that. They sauté them. They take the small, when they're fairly young, and they sauté them with butter and shallot or onion. And then they're eaten the way you would eat any kind of green that you would sauté. So it's worth a try, I think.
Yeah, I'll definitely give that a shot.
And, I'm just wondering, is this something that you could chop up and add to a tomato soup at the last minute? Something that tends to have a sweet, acidic quality to it. A cold tomato soup, and you would just sprinkle the fresh hops on them. Now, I've never cooked with hops, so I'm just doing some guesses here. But try sautéing. but you want young shoots, okay?
Okay.
And then I think of them as a garnish where you want a bitter edge. And I'm just trying to think, hey, you know what would be really interesting? When the melons, the local melons are coming in, the musk melons, you know, the cantaloupes?
Yeah, I actually have those growing as well.
Wouldn't it be interesting to slick that with a little honey, grill the melon wedges, and then sprinkle a little bit of minced hop on top?
That sounds delicious.
Doesn't that sound like it could work?
Yeah.
Okay, give it a shot. I mean, the worst thing that you've got them growing there anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for a great question. I mean, I haven't run into this one before.
Thanks, Lynn.
You take care. Bye.
Bye.
Reach us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. I went out to California to attend the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch Sustainability Institute. In the van from the airport to the hotel, I met Dr. Eric Prince, a scientist with NOAA. That's the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. Well, we got into talking about the state of the oceans and his research, and then he mentioned how excited he was about a recent discovery. So I've got him on the phone. Eric, good to talk with you again.
Good morning.
You told me about hypoxia. Could you explain what it is and what you found?
Hypoxia is a term for diminished oxygen in the oceans. There are areas in the oceans that lack dissolved oxygen, and of course 95% of all the marine organisms in the ocean depend on adequate levels of dissolved oxygen. And basically what happened in my research is that I was looking at the vertical habitat use of Atlantic blue marlin and sailfish and first comparing that to the same species in the eastern Pacific off the Pacific side of Central America and looking at their use of the water column. And what happened was when I looked at the data at first, I couldn't understand why the same blue marlin in the western North Atlantic can go down to over 104 meters and into water as cold as 9.7 degrees Celsius at its deepest dives, while the exact same animal on the Pacific side of Central America hardly went past 150, 200 meters. And the answer to that question turned out to be hypoxia-based habitat compression. And it's an oceanographic feature that only occurs on the western side of continents. In the Atlantic, it occurs off West Africa. And in the Pacific, it occurs off the Pacific side of Central America.
Okay.
And because the animals can't survive very long in an area with no oxygen, they tend to be squeezed by this hypoxia into a very narrow layer at the surface of the ocean. So the problem in this is that in the process of being compressed near the surface, they become a lot more vulnerable to over-exploitation by surface skiers. And this involves some of our most important food fish, yellowfin tuna, for example. And yellowfin in the Atlantic were declared over-exploited for the very first time in 2009 by the International Commission for Conservation of Atlantic Tunas. And our current cycle of climate change and escalated global warming, for every degree the surface mixed layer temperature increases, less dissolved oxygen can be forced into the surface waters. So this increasing temperature is fueling an expansion of the oxygen minimum zone.
So at this point, we have a lot more fish that are very vulnerable to being caught and very desirable going to the surface of the ocean.
Yes.
Which could also lead to people thinking there's more of those fish than there really are.
Well, that's the real point, because scientists, when they do stock assessments, the classical way is to look at indices of abundance. And one of the most relied upon anywhere in the world is called catch per unit effort. And when you have a high catch per unit effort, in theory, that's supposed to be indicative of a healthy population.
And it may not be the case.
Right.
But how widespread is this lack of oxygen, this hypoxia, in the Atlantic, for instance?
Well, you know, it's really surprising. What we did is we plotted out what the dissolved oxygen levels were at 100-meter depths. Uh-huh. And when we did this, the size of the oxygen minimum zone about knocked us off our chair. I mean, it is immensely large. It starts up North Africa. It comes across the ocean. And at this point in time, it actually touches part of South America in the area of French Guiana.
You're talking about the entire width of the Atlantic Ocean?
That's the problem. It encompasses all, virtually all of the equatorial waters in the Atlantic, which are prime fishing grounds for big-eye tuna and yellowfin tuna and swordfish. So it impacts all these incredibly important food fish. And it also, in the process, impacts our blue marlin, our white marlin, and our sailfish. And all of those are overexploited in the Atlantic Ocean. So it's a dominant oceanographic feature. And its size, if you could see it on a map, it's so big that the continental United States could fit very comfortably within its borders.
And this is increasing regularly?
Yes. Since in the last 50 years, it's increased in size by about 15%. Uh-huh. And it's shoaling closer to the surface. And so each year, there's a meter or so less habitat in this part of the ocean. So this is the concern, and it affects a lot of animals, and it's so large. In this case, size makes a difference.
Eric, thanks so much for talking with us about this.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
One of the layman's terms for hypoxia is dead zone, a pretty vivid image. Dr. Eric Prince is chief of the Migratory Fishery Biology Branch of NOAA's Southeast Fisheries. And that's our show for this week. Thanks for being with us. Remember, you can reach us anywhere you want. Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or actually pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Lao Tzu, who said, "Governing a great nation is like cooking a small fish. Too much handling will spoil it." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Check out our new series of podcasts, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. And take a look at our newest project, a summertime grilling guide, 40 recipes to get you cooking outside this summer. All the information is, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Peters and Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. You have a good one. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.